Gary, you are not only a celebrated writer, you're a literary phenomenon. Your novels win awards and people actually buy them. You made a video with James Franco that went viral. You're a world-famous blurber of other people's books. Why would a successful guy like you title his memoir Little Failure?
Well, Little Failure was a cute nickname that my mom had for me when I was growing up. When I graduated from Oberlin College in Ohio, they expected me to, after $100,000 in tuition, to become a lawyer or something like that. And I came out to them and said, look, I want to be a writer. And one day my mother was visiting my apartment, a 100-square-foot apartment on the Lower East Side, which back then Manhattan wasn't fully gentrified completely. And I was living in this tiny place with sloping floors and a water bug so big he looked like he could have been my roommate, you know. And she looked around and said, my God, you're such a failure, chka, which is in the diminutive word of failure, the English word failure, but chka makes it little. So that was my moniker, and it kind of stuck, you know.
Well, the chka makes it sound little and sort of sweet. I mean, does that make it sort of affectionate?
Yeah, she was affectionately saying that I was a little failure.
So this seems kind of characteristic of your family, the barbed joke, the hostility disguised as affection, or vice versa.
Or vice versa.
Yeah. So is this, do you think it's a Russian thing or a family tradition or both?
Well, it could be a Russian thing, although I you know, since the book came out, I've been touring a lot, and people from all kinds of different ethnicities have been coming up and saying, yeah, I'm getting that too, you know. That kind of barbed humor, and also the constant put-downs. And the constant put-downs are supposed to make sure that the child, even if the child is, let's say, 37 years old, still goes on to medical school or dental school or law school and fulfills the parents' ambitions, because the parents had to give up everything to come to this country, you know. And so the child feels it upon themselves to continue that tradition. One reader in New York came up to have her book signed, and she said, can you sign it to, quote, a little failure's failed paralegal? And I almost cried. I thought, you poor woman, you're not a failure. You can do whatever you want.
Do you think that's true, that it's the parents constantly wanting to push the kid forward? Or do you think it's the parents actually feel like failures themselves, and your kids are just part of you, and so you kind of can't separate?
Sure. I think that's a very important fact, is that, you know, they come from cultures where children are seen to a large extent as an extension of the family. Where do your parents end and where do you begin? I've always wondered that.
America,
me too. It's such a culture clash, because America encourages endless individualism. You're always you and you're always special. But if you come from a society where the family unit is seen as the paramount unit, well, you're not that special. You're just an extension of your parents. And that's something that's very hard to reconcile. And it took me years and decades, really, to get there, including the 12 years of psychoanalysis. So, you know,
well, so
the fun never ends.
Well, so it sounds like you grew up in a family in which there was almost always a subtext or a double meaning.
Yes, and that is great for a writer. It's important. I mean, the jokes they tell, the satire they use, the stuff that you mentioned, you know, is hostility masquerading as affection, or affection masquerading as hostility, all that kind of stuff is wonderful for a writer. I encourage all writers to be called Little Failure by their parents, all budding writers, because it really focuses your mind on language and the way language is used. And even if it's not used in a way that soothes you, it will be material at some point.
Mm. Now, well, that was why I asked, because I think that although that sounds like a damaging, somewhat, environment, it probably was really great training for a writer. So how do you think that shaped your particular voice and your interests as a writer?
Well, before my memoir, the three books I've written have been satires. And I think that growing up with parents from the Soviet Union, growing up partly in the Soviet Union, telling Brezhnev jokes was just how people bonded, making fun of the government, making fun of the ridiculous system. So I think I always grew up with a very kind of jaundiced eye, just looking at things very skeptically. That's not a great way to be as a person, but it's a great way to be as a writer. You know, most writers I know are probably not going to win Happiest Woman or Happiest Man of the Year awards. They just aren't that happy. And especially the funny writers, I notice. You know, the funnier you are, the more I think there's a tragic undercurrent.
Now, why do you think that is?
Because I think humor is one of the highest forms of tragedy there is. People talk about the serious novel in these sort of hallowed tones and how important it is. But I think a lot of the humorous stuff, you know, books by writers like Sam Lipsight and writers like Mordecai Richler in Canada, who's no longer with us. But these are some of the most funny and tragic books I know because there's no humor doesn't work unless you're making fun of something that keeps paper cutting you throughout your life, something that keeps hurting you. And that's why parents and relationships and the political system are such delicious targets.
Hmm. That's funny. I was trying to think, do I know any writers who had happy childhoods? I think I know one.
You know one. Well, I'd love to meet him or her and take notes. You know?
That could probably be arranged. Well, you said your parents didn't want you to become a writer, but I thought the Russians revered their writers. Why didn't they want you to be one?
Well, they wanted me to be a writer in the sense of it being a hobby, you know. So you go to Cornell Law School and you practice law, but then for fun on weekends you write a little bit.
No, or you could be William Carlos Williams, right? Or yeah, you could write on the side as long as you also were a doctor or lawyer.
It's somehow easier for poets, you know, T.S. Eliot working in the bank and stuff like that. But novelists, I don't know, it's a little bit tougher. I mean, it can be done, but I'm not that industrious, to be honest.
So they didn't dream of nurturing the next Chekhov or Dostoevsky?
And Chekhov was a doctor, by the way, but I don't know how much he practiced after his writing took off. But no, they did not.
The really depressing thing, which is both depressing, painful, and funny, the way you tell it is, they're still sort of like that. There was this comment your father made to you, it sounded like not that long ago, when he said, I think by then you were a successful writer, and he said something like, yeah, well, a friend of mine told me nobody will ever remember your books.
No, the actual quote was, I read on the Russian internet that soon you and your novels will be forgotten, which I loved so much that I remember taking out my phone and just typing it down. It just sounded so awesome and so almost Old Testament, you know, soon you and your novel will be forgotten.
And there's so much buried in that.
I read on the Russian internet. So some Masha from Minsk said, you know, whatever. But that's, you know, yeah, so it doesn't really, it never really ends. You know, you can be a big success, but if Misha from Murmansk says you're a schmuck, then you're a schmuck.
I thought I heard overtones of kind of Soviet hatred of the capitalist pig Americans in there, too. You know, so the Russian internet says, soon, you capitalist writer.
Yeah,
your works will be forgotten.
You know, one of the headlines, not the headlines, but one of the reviews of one of my books in Russian was, you know, balding traitor betrays motherland. So there's a fine tradition of that. But I remember watching a documentary where Woody Allen goes back to his parents and his mother, you know, and they say, well, how do you feel about all your son's successes? And the mother said, I still think he should have been a pharmacist, you know.
Right.
So it never ends.
Yeah. So I want to go back to your very beginnings as a writer. You have a wonderful memory of writing your first, admittedly very short, novel at the tender age of 5, I think. Yeah. What was it? It was something about
Lenin,
a goose.
Lenin and his magical goose. And my grandmother commissioned, my grandmother was a journalist for Evening Leningrad, a newspaper in Leningrad. And she said, you know, can you write a small novel for me? And I'll pay you a slice of cheese for each page you write. And I loved the Soviet cheese. I was very excited. So I wrote 100 pages for 100 slices of cheese. And it was called Lenin and His Magical Goose. And I loved Lenin. There was a huge statue. The biggest statue of Lenin in all of Leningrad was right outside of our building. And so I wrote a novel in which Lenin meets a magical goose from a southern clime, Armenia or Georgia, let's say, and they invade Finland and they create a socialist revolution in Finland. They make Finland safe for socialism. But then a fight breaks out between Lenin and the goose, and Lenin eats the goose because the goose is Menshevik and Lenin is Bolshevik. So, so a five-year-old kid, but, you know, in Russia, a five-year-old could be a pretty well-educated kid.
Yeah, but that's such a dark and depressing story. I mean, already with the betrayal.
Already with the betrayal, already political arguments are breaking out, geese are being eaten, you know. But it's tragicomic when you think about it, you know.
Yeah. Well, so then there's another kind of key moment in your development as a writer. It's some years later, you've emigrated to the U.S. where you are, of course, one of those deeply unpopular, picked-on kids at school. What didn't they like about you?
You got to remember, this is 1980, and it's the evil empire era, Reagan's evil empire speech, and the movies are out there, the Red Dawn, you know, Red Hamster, whatever, you know, it's just, it never ends. And so the kids are pushing me into the wall and screaming Rusky and Commie and all that. And I'm pretending I was born in East Berlin instead of being born in Leningrad. I'm in a Hebrew school. I'm trying to get Jewish kids to think I'm a German because that's better than being a Russian, you know. Mm. And at the same time, I start writing these little science fiction books because I love science fiction. And there's a very nice teacher who lets me read them at the end of each English period. And then I write the Gnora, which is a satire in the Torah, you know, where Exodus becomes Sexodus and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, the point is that I make my first friends. Through writing, I make my first friends. Earlier, because of my writing, my grandmother gave me cheese and loved me. And Random House still pays me in cheese. The tradition continues, you know. And now these kids like me because I write. So somewhere inside my psyche is the idea is born that the only way I can get people to really like me is by constantly writing. Or if I stop writing, I'm the Red Hamster again.
So was never that really, stop writing. Was that really the name they called you?
No. But because of all movies like Red Dawn, I thought Red Hamster would be a fine title or Red Gerbil, maybe something like that.
This was, you said, the 80s when you were a school kid in the U.S. But going back earlier, you were born in Leningrad in 1972. This would have been the twilight of the Soviet Union.
Yes. I mean,
it's funny because now enough time has passed that people are nostalgic about those years. You know, the old Soviet posters and the architecture and the uniforms. Do you remember those years as a happy time?
I do. You know, the Soviet childhood was when the child became a young adult. That's when the system really went to town on you and all the ideology and all the lies and the nonsense. But when you were a kid, the system really invested a lot of time and money in making sure that kids had very good educations, were well taken care of, you know. So those were not unhappy times. Everyone was deeply studious. Think of a nation of nerds playing chess and you know, and listening to Rachmaninoff and reading Chekhov. I mean, these were very good times from what I can recall of them. Mm-hmm. The only problem was I had terrible asthma. I was very sick. And there were no steroid inhalers. The country was very backwards in that kind of sense. So, you know, every week the ambulance would come and take me to the hospital. And then
ambulance. You were seriously. So you came close to dying?
Yeah, but if you have asthma and you don't have an inhaler, you have to be taken to the hospital if it's a very serious case of asthma. You know, and when we got to Vienna, they had these asthma inhalers. And the first night in the West, I was able to breathe finally without any problems. So talk about metaphor. Yeah. You leave the Soviet Union and you're able to breathe.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that surely sheds some light on your relationship with your parents also. I mean, it's complicated and difficult to have a chronically ill child.
I think so. And you know, they were wonderful to you know, they were very, my father would stay up in the middle of the night, my mother too, keeping my mouth open with their finger or a spoon to make sure that my airways were clear, that I wasn't going to die, you know. So I think that had a big effect. Also, it heightened their anxiety. My mother already was a very anxious woman, but having somebody so sick as a child obviously heightened her anxiety quite a bit.
Mm. When you moved here to the U.S., your parents changed your name from Igor to Gary. And they must have thought that would help you fit in with the other kids, but it just seems like such a symbolic, loaded thing to do, especially for a writer to whom names are important.
Well, look, I mean, being Russian was already problematic enough. He didn't want to have a name like Igor, who also happens to be Frankenstein's assistant. So we all chipped in here and we all were trying out different names. You know, Greg was a possibility. But I think Gary Cooper is so beloved by Russians that it's hard to say no to Gary. Although now it's such a weird name. It feels like a very old-fashioned kind of name. I don't think I have any friends named Gary.
Well, did you take to the name right away? Did you like it and just drop Igor? Or did you feel for a while like somebody who had two identities?
Oh, well, I felt like I had two identities, but I couldn't wait to get away from Igor in terms of the kids around me. Oh, my God. But still, you know, so I was Gary all the way, and then I would come home, and they'd be calling me Igoryochik, which means little Igor. You know, that would be, and to this day, my parents call me Igoryochik, so the tradition continues, you know. And it's weird, but at the same time, I like it. I like the fact that I have more than one identity.
Yeah, well, that kind of relates again to your, you know, your sort of writing style, which is often so filled with ambivalence. And there's a kind of, I don't know, I've always thought your sense of humor has a kind of trickster nature to it. But I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, there is a kind of, because there's always two soundtracks going on in my mind. And I want to do something Russian with everything I write. Which is weird because this memoir reveals so much about my life that I don't know how much Russian material is left in me. I think the next book will have to be something that's completely different because the larder is empty. I gave it all away. One of the first interviews I had after, I think the first interview I had after publishing this book was with the writer Francine Prose, who is a friend of mine. And she said, after reading this memoir, I think I know you better than my husband of 20 years. Which I took as a compliment, but also as a call to action in terms of the next book will have to be about something very different from my tales of the Russian Soviet Nebish, you know.
But this must be something many writers deal with, don't you think? Because surely most writers, you're mining all your past history and who you are and all your impressions. There must, if you publish enough, there must get to you must get to a point where you're kind of panicked that you've run out of material.
Well, one of my heroes is Philip Roth, and he wrote about American Jews in a way that hadn't been written before. And then after Goodbye Columbus, I think there was a lot of pushback, and rabbis were, you know, ranting about him on the stage. And I think one of them said something like, medieval Jews would know what to do with such a person. And he retreated for a while into this kind of social realism, what he wrote about, you know, young women in the Midwest, and he everything he writes is so beautiful, but it was clearly he was writing about things that weren't a part of the life that he knew growing up in Newark, New Jersey. And eventually he did come back. You know, Portnoy's Complaint signaled a huge return to form and a huge return to the subjects. So there are some writers, look at Faulkner, for example, who's, I can never pronounce it, but, you know, Yapahaka, Waka County or whatever the heck it's called. The part, you know, the county where he sets all of his books is, it's brilliantly done, and he doesn't have to leave the confines of that. But I feel like I do need to expand my horizon somewhat with future books. I mean, I'm a travel writer for one thing, and I constantly find myself traveling around the world from Asia to Latin America to anywhere else. And so I think it's important for me to write about other places too.
Well, it sounds like having grown up with a double identity, you now are craving an additional one, a triple or a quarter identity.
Yeah, I remember living in Rome for a while, and I mean, it's beautiful to live in Rome, but I wanted to recapture that feeling of being an immigrant again, of not knowing the language, of not knowing the local customs, of feeling a little bit apart from everyone else, because being completely immersed in a culture and being completely a part of it feels a little strange to me. It doesn't feel always as satisfactory as the other way.
Wait, which way? Being apart from doesn't feel...
Being apart from other people. No, being a part of a culture doesn't always... you know, in New York, for example, where I live for most of the year, everyone's from somewhere else. So there isn't a feeling of being, of visiting someplace new. You feel like you're just like everyone else in a way. That's why travel, whenever you travel, you land someplace and for a couple of weeks, you're an immigrant all over again. Even in the end, you do go home. But there is that feeling that I love of being someplace that's where I don't belong.
Yeah.
You know, that feeling is very...
The perpetual expat.
But that really inspires the fiction that I write.
And I know exactly what you mean, but why do you think that's so pleasurable?
pleasurable maybe isn't the right word. It's maybe instructive. We live in a world, I think, where more and more people will move all over the world, you know. And I think, you know, putting on my science fiction hat, you know, in 100 years, those trends will only be exacerbated because the planet is warming up. Huge parts of the planet will surely be uninhabitable sooner rather than later. Right now you're talking to me, I'm in Miami, which is one of my favorite cities. I love Miami quite a bit. But whenever I drive across the bridges to Miami Beach, I think, how long before this beautiful part of the Earth is underwater? And according to scientists, it might be less than a century before, unless, you know, huge provocative measures are taken to surround it with giant seawalls or not. So what will happen to the millions of billions of people around the world who will have to get up and move? And so being an immigrant as a child, I feel like I'm almost looking into the future. I mean, I was being interviewed with the writer Chang Rae Lee, who has a dystopian novel, a wonderful dystopian novel, On a Full Sea, that was just published. Mm-hmm. And the interviewer asked us about why, you know, there's two of us who are immigrants and we're writing dystopian fiction. My last book was a dystopian novel. And Chang Rae said, all immigrant fiction is dystopian fiction. And I think he's right.
It's interesting. I was thinking that if you feel fundamentally that you don't belong, which is the immigrant experience, or in fact the experience of somebody who's grown up, say, in an unhappy family situation, or any kid who has ever been bullied, but if you have that feeling inside that you don't belong, I think being an expatriate or an outsider in some other country feels good because finally your outside matches your inside.
Right, right. And, you know, there are many expats who live these very gilded lives where they're expats, especially expats in a poor country who go, you know, their kids go to the American school and their life revolves around country clubs and golf courses and things like that. But when I moved to Rome, I somehow ended up, almost unconsciously, I ended up in the immigrant ghetto of Rome, which is certainly not the prettiest part of Rome, but certainly one of the most exciting. Surrounded by people from Pakistan and Bangladesh and Ethiopia. And, you know, the circumstances were slightly different. I'd already published my first book. I wasn't wealthy, but I had, you know, some means. But I just felt such happiness being in a country where I didn't speak the language well, being surrounded by other people who were also trying to adapt to it. It just felt like serendipity to me.
In some ways, no pressure to belong because there wasn't any hope of belonging.
Yes, and you know, and I'm a huge eater, and as much as I adore Italian food, I love the fact that there was an Ethiopian restaurant next door which served amazing injera, the spongy flatbread, mm. and that just made me so happy.
Well, I'm curious about your own early immigrant experience here. I mean, growing up in the Soviet Union, you must have been taught that the U.S. was the enemy. Did it feel at first like you had just moved to enemy territory?
Not exactly. I mean, because on the way to America, my parents said, look, you know, everything in the Soviet Union was a lie. No more worshiping the Red Army or Lenin, no more Lenin and his magical goose. From now on, you know, when we got here, it was all Reagan all the way. It was amazing how quickly we switched our allegiances from Lenin to Reagan. You know, well, my parents never had allegiances to Lenin, but I certainly did. And I think in a way, growing up in a communist country, then becoming for, you know, a decade a young Republican and all that, it just, when I became an adult, I never really trusted any belief system. It all felt like just you know, ideology and dogma to me. And so whether religious or social or political, I never quite cleaved to any kind of movement or any school of thought. I just wanted to be left alone.
Yeah, and I suppose you could also see the absurdity in every possible ideology. There's a really funny passage that I wondered if you would read for us.
Okay.
Did you bring your book?
I did.
Yes. Okay, great. It's the passage about your family receiving a letter from the publisher's clearinghouse.
Okay.
So I think that starts at the top of page 131 and ends at the bottom of 133. And you can't say shit guard on the radio, so if you don't mind changing it to, I don't know, okay, shit guard, and you can't say fucking on the radio either.
Okay. Okay. You know what? As I read it, I actually have my own slightly different version of it.
Perfect.
That okay?
Absolutely. Of course it's okay. It's your writing.
I know, but it doesn't quite follow the...
No. Whatever you want to read is great.
Okay. All right.
Maybe you could just set it up for us.
This is about 2 years after we leave Russia, and we are not wealthy. I wear a fur coat and a fur hat made out of some woodland animal to school. The teachers actually take me aside and say, you know, you really need to get rid of your fur. Kids will play with you more if you're, you know, furless. And we're very poor. And then something happens that will change our life forever. In 1981, an official letter arrives in our mailbox. Mr. S. Steingart, you have already won $10 million. Oh, my God. Cardstock this thick cannot lie. The letter is from a major American publisher, to wit, the Publisher's Clearing House. You know what? Let me reread that, and let me make it Swinegard or something like that.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good.
Because then the joke is sort of... Mm. In 1981, an official letter arrives in our mailbox. Mr. S. Swinegart, you have already won $10 million. Sure, our last name is misspelled rather cruelly, but cardstock this thick does not lie. And the letter is from a major American publisher, to wit, the Publisher's Clearing House. I open the letter with shaking hands, and a check falls out. Pay to the order of S. Swinegart, $10 million and $00/$100. Our lives are about to change. I run down the stairs into the courtyard of our apartment complex. Mama, Papa, we won, we won. We are millionaires. Calm down, my father says. Do you want an asthma attack? But he's nervous and excited himself. Around the glowing surface of the orange dining table imported from Romania, we spread around the contents of the voluminous packet. For 2 years, we have been good news citizens, while accidentally watching X-rated movies on Main Street, getting jobs as engineers and clerk typists, learning to pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and for the something for which that it stands, unavoidable with money for all. Bonjour, moi, my mother says, my God, as we look at the pictures on the envelope of a Mercedes flying off the deck of our yacht toward our new mansion with its Olympic-sized swimming pool. Oi, does it have to be a Mercedes? Pooh, they're Nazis. Don't worry, we can trade it for a Cadillac. Bonjour, moi, how many bedrooms does this house have? 7, 8, 9. You can forget about the yacht, Gary, it's dangerous. But I know how to swim, Mama. How do you keep the pool open in the winter? Snow will get in. Look, there's palm trees. Maybe it's in Florida. Florida won't be good for your asthma with all that humidity. I want to live in Miami. Maybe there aren't Hebrew schools in Miami. Everywhere in America, there are Hebrew schools. We sit down and, using our collective 400-word English vocabulary, begin to unravel the many documents before us. It says that, yes, we have already won the $10 million. There's no disputing that. But a panel of judges still has to award the money to us. First, we must fill out the winner's form and to select 5 national magazines that will be sent to us free, or at least the first issues of each will be free, and then the Americans will likely send us the rest of the money. Fair enough. First, we must acclimate to our new wealth, expand our literacy. I am proud of my papa's new car, a bulbous 1977 Chevrolet Malibu Classic with only seven million miles on the odometer, but it is time to get acquainted with the finer autos. So I order car and motor, motor and driver, carburetor and driver, muffler and owner, and for the last selection, something that maybe has my Star Wars monkey, Chewie Chewbacca, in it, Isaac Asimov science fiction magazine. I walk solemnly to the mailbox and deposit our claim on the future. Adonai Eloheinu, I pray to our new God, please help us get the $10 million so that Mama and Papa will not fight so much and there will be no razvod, divorce between them, and let us live somewhere far away from Papa's wolfish relatives who cause all the trouble, and let them not yell at Mama when she sends the money Papa says we don't have to her sisters and Grandmother Galia in Leningrad, who has been dying for a very long time. Amen. That night in my dreams, I walk into the Solomon Schechter School of Queens, a multimillionaire, and the pretty girl with the big teeth, who's always tanned from her Florida vacation, kisses me with those big teeth. I haven't gotten the mechanics of kissing down yet. The kids make fun of Jonah Himmelstein, the school's biggest loser, but I say, hey, he's my friend now. Here is $2. Buy us both the Carvel Flying Saucer cookie ice cream and keep the change, you garnished, you nothing.
Oh, it's hilarious and it's heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah, I mean,
is that a good memory?
Yeah, that's one of the better ones. I mean, it's heartbreaking that we didn't win, but...
I don't know. There's something sort of sad about it. You know, there must have been so many ways, so many occasions in which you felt kind of subtly tricked by America, you know, as though everything is a lie and a trick.
Well, that's what was so surprising, is that in the Soviet Union, you expected that the government would always lie to you, but... Here, you know, you get an envelope from the publisher's clearinghouse, my God, you know, and it has, you know, all that wonderful stuff on it. There's a picture of, there's the logo with the house. I mean, it's very, very important. And you have your last name, even if it's misspelled, but, you know, okay, they got it wrong a little bit, but you've won. I mean, the country's welcomed us, and now they're going to give us our rightful due, the $10 million. And then, of course, it hurts when they don't.
Yeah. You write a lot about, in the memoir, about the past. And the past, and your family's past in the Soviet Union is, of course, overshadows everything in the novel and in your childhood. You wound up going back with your parents to the Soviet Union in 2011. Was that a pivotal trip? Did it put anything to rest?
It did. It did. You know, you grew up with tough immigrant parents. And in your 20s, earlier than that, maybe even a little bit later than that, they want you so much to be who they want you to be. You develop a huge sense of anger toward them, rage sometimes. And I think going back with them and seeing the difficulties of how they grew up, of how much apart Stalin and Hitler were of their earliest years, you know, they were born to a bombed out country. My father's first memory is diving under a train as the Germans strafed the train and they were being evacuated from Leningrad. After a while, you hear these stories and you see them walk through the places where all these things happened. And the feelings of rage become feelings of sorrow and sadness and a kind of sorrow that they didn't grow up in a better country under better circumstances, that they didn't have a chance to pursue the dreams that they wanted to pursue. My father wanted very much to be an opera singer. And I think in a normal country, his beautiful voice maybe would have had a chance, but certainly not there.
Yeah. You discovered just walking around the streets with them, pieces of their past that you had never heard of. And you grew up with parents who, you know, are wonderful storytellers. But, I mean, there's this horrible thing. Your father said something about he'd been in a hospital, in a mental...
We've been in a mental hospital, yeah. Yeah, right. That... We were walking past the street, and he said that he had had a kind of very hard to, you know, the psychiatry was so poorly done in the Soviet Union that who knows what the real, I mean, maybe it was a kind of nervous breakdown or something like that. But because of that and something that would have been easily treatable in America with psychotherapy or with some other form, they put him in a mental institution for a while, and he was surrounded by people who were, you know, smearing excrement on the walls and shouting. And you know, it was a horrible thing that I think really, really destroyed a part of his life, you know, and it was very sad.
Yeah. I'm trying to decide whether it's sometimes the older you get and the more you see of your parents, they wind up becoming kind of smaller figures. And then there's a way in which you kind of miss the large, sort of over-large figures they were when you were a child. And it's sort of like you can't ever be quite satisfied.
You can't be quite satisfied. And you know, you try to replicate your parents in the relationships you have. You're searching for something familiar, even though that may not be good for you. And writing is the other way that I've gone through. I mean, in all four books have dealt with parent and child relationships. My last book, Super Sad True Love Story, had a Russian-American family contrasted with a Korean-American family, and you saw sort of matching both the wonderful things about both families and the dysfunctional things.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for talking and for sharing the story of your parents. They are, for all their foibles, they sound like amazing people.
They are amazing people. Thank you.
Thank you.